Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views with Chris Fitzsimon.
Welcome to another edition of News and Views. Thanks for joining us. Next week, the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has agreed to hear an expedited appeal of a lower court's refusal to block voting law changes from taking effect this November. For North Carolina voters, the lower court's refusal means that for this election cycle, there would be no same-day registration, early voting days would be reduced from 17 to 10, and votes cast out of precinct would not be counted. Joining us this week to talk about the voting rights case, along with marriage equality and the now infamous Hobby Lobby ruling in our federal courts, is Ian Millhiser, Senior Constitutional Policy Analyst at the Center for American Progress. Welcome to Raleigh. Thanks for being with us. We appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you very much.
Let's jump in and talk about what's happening in the federal courts, a case that has a big impact on North Carolina and maybe the country, a voting rights decision recently that a judge ruled that the 2014 elections can go ahead under the new law. What's the significance of that decision?
Well, it's a hugely significant decision. You know, North Carolina has what is probably the worst voter suppression law in the country at this point. You know, the North Carolina legislature basically took all of the bad laws that all these other states had come up with, combined them all together into one bill and passed it. And before the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, there really wasn't much question that most, or at least much of this law was going to be stopped. Under what's called Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, the state had an obligation to prove that the new law wouldn't suppress minority votes. Now that the Supreme Court has more or less gutted Section 5, there is potentially a way to stop this law, but the burden is on the people challenging it to prove that it suppresses minority votes. That's a heavy lift, and we saw how heavy a lift it was when this judge said that he wouldn't suspend it, at least for the 2014 election.
For people who don't follow the courts closely, what bearing, if any, does it have on how you think this case will ultimately be resolved before this judge? It doesn't mean that the case still goes forward. The election still goes forward under the new law.
That's right. The case still goes forward. The problem is that, so the legal term for what the plaintiffs were seeking at this point is a preliminary injunction, which means that they wanted to stop the law from going into effect, or at least halt the law before a full trial happens. And the standard to get a preliminary injunction is you have to show a likelihood of prevailing on the merits. And the judge said that they didn't have a likelihood of prevailing on the merits. So that's not good news for the plaintiffs. You know, there is some nuance to his opinion. He didn't really consider the voter ID provision of the law, which is one of the more offensive provisions, and that's because that doesn't go into effect until 2016, so there's no reason for a preliminary injunction to stop something in 2014 that isn't in effect in 2014. So it's possible, you know, the judge will halt that provision, but the plaintiffs are not on great grounds right now.
Let's move to another issue that's been in the headlines quite a bit. The U.S. Supreme Court issued a stay in the ruling in the Fourth Circuit about marriage equality in a Virginia case. Obviously, North Carolina is in the Fourth Circuit. For people who are trying to keep up with this, it's a little confusing. So where are we in the battle for marriage equality in North Carolina and around the country?
I don't think you can read too much into this stay. It's very common when there's a case that the Supreme Court is likely to hear that they'll want to maintain whatever the status quo was before the lawsuits were filed. And the status quo in North Carolina and Virginia and the rest of the Fourth Circuit, unfortunately, is not marriage equality. So I wouldn't read too much into the stay. I'm fairly optimistic both that the court's going to take this case and that ultimately the forces of equality are going to win. This is one of the few issues where gay rights is really the only issue where you've seen fairly consistent progress over the last 20 or so years. Slow progress, but consistent progress. And the reason for that can be summed up in three words: Justice Anthony Kennedy. Kennedy is very conservative on most issues. You know, on abortion, he has considered 21 laws making it more difficult to get an abortion, and he has upheld 20 of them. He wanted to repeal the entire Affordable Care Act. This is a very conservative man. But for whatever reason, he thinks the gays are fabulous. And so, you know, that's great. That means that on same-sex marriage, he's likely to provide the fifth vote in order to say that, you know, marriage discrimination violates the Constitution. This is the one issue where I'm fairly optimistic about the future.
I was talking to an attorney with the North Carolina ACLU recently about the expected backlash. What do conservatives do, as they're clearly going to lose the marriage equality argument that got us sort of to the Hobby Lobby case and the claims in various ways from conservatives that these laws violate somehow their religious freedom by providing equality to everybody else. So how do you sort of put that into context and give us an idea about where the Hobby Lobby philosophy is taking us?
It's a really good question. You know, we don't really know what the impact of Hobby Lobby is going to be. The rule before Hobby Lobby was essentially that my religious freedom stops at your body. So I had fairly sweeping ability to practice my own faith, to assert my own conscience. But the minute I try to use that right in order to diminish your rights or someone else's rights, that's when the Supreme Court typically said no. And that is especially true in the business context. Hobby Lobby blows that regime up and said, you know, in Hobby Lobby, the issue was that there were people who had a legal right to have birth control included in their plans. The company didn't want to provide it. And for the first time, they said that the company can make a religious liberty argument in order to diminish the rights of their employees. What Hobby Lobby also said, because everyone knows that the next big religious liberty case is likely to be an anti-discrimination case where someone wants to discriminate, claims that it's part of their religion. And Justice Alito's opinion rather pointedly said that if it is a race case, then he thinks that racial discrimination is something that a religious liberty claim will not permit. But when he said that, he rather pointedly did not say that if it is a case of sexist discrimination or if it is a case of anti-gay discrimination, that a religious liberty claim will not work in those cases. There's some nuance to it. Hobby Lobby only applies to federal laws. It doesn't apply to state laws. You know, in states like New Mexico, where there was a case that recently came up to the Supreme Court, a state law protected people against anti-gay discrimination. Hobby Lobby might not impact that, but there are all kinds of ways that the federal law can wind up protecting gay couples. You know, there are federal laws which protect the benefits of married people. And if you are gay and you are married, that includes you. There are lots of laws that have an incidental benefit for gay people, even if they do not specifically mention sexual orientation in the law. And so the danger is that someone's going to sue to challenge those laws on religious grounds. And Justice Alito, at least, has telegraphed that if it is a case of anti-gay discrimination, he might say that a religious liberty claim trumps the interest of the gay couple there.
How does the Hobby Lobby decision factor into the whole discussion about the personhood of corporations?
That was another side issue in the case, and it's another issue that we've never seen before. You know, the Supreme Court had never before Hobby Lobby said that a for-profit corporation can assert a religious liberty claim. And there's an intuitive reason why they've never said that before. You know, corporations don't have souls. Corporations don't pray. How exactly does a for-profit corporation practice religion? You know, it's a concept that doesn't really make much intuitive sense. But the Supreme Court has now said that they can. Now, I don't actually think that was the most important issue in Hobby Lobby. I think that the scary thing about Hobby Lobby isn't the fact that for-profit companies, or at least some for-profit companies, may be able to assert religious liberty claims. The really scary thing about Hobby Lobby is the fact that they took away this longstanding rule, you know, the my religious liberty stops at your body rule. And without that, there really could be no limits on the sort of claims that people can assert in order to immunize themselves from the law.
You mentioned access to abortion services earlier. We don't hear much about that in North Carolina. We did pass a very restrictive law a couple years ago, but in terms of the court system, a lot of people still think Roe v. Wade is going to be there, but that may not be the case.
The greatest trick the Supreme Court ever pulled was convincing the world that Roe v. Wade still exists. They've been chipping away at Roe for at least 20, 25 years now. You know, as I said, Justice Kennedy, and he's been on the court since, I think, 1987, has considered 21 restrictions on abortion. He's upheld 20 of them. The scary issue that could come up for abortion rights supporters next term is that, you know, it could come up in one of two ways. A lot of states are passing what I would describe as sham health laws. So a common version of what are sometimes referred to as trap laws, where they regulate abortion clinics and they put very onerous architectural requirements on them. So the halls have to be so wide and the rooms have to have certain facilities. And they'll also say that the doctors have to have certain credentials. Frequently, it's admitting privileges in a nearby hospital that are really irrelevant to the practice of medicine in an abortion clinic and really irrelevant to patient health and safety. But they look like health laws. And if you stretch, you can come up with a justification like, oh, the wider halls are needed because what happens if you have two stretchers going through and you need enough room for both of them? The real purpose of these laws is to make it economically and administratively difficult or impossible to run a clinic. Again, the question is, where is the limit where the court says, okay, this is too much of a sham? What if North Carolina passed a law saying no doctor can perform an abortion unless they complete a 100,000-hour training class taught by the Pope? At some point, the laws become so ridiculous that there needs to be a stopping point. And if the Supreme Court doesn't establish a stopping point, then Roe v. Wade really doesn't exist in any meaningful sense.
Thank you very much for what you're doing, and we appreciate you being in Raleigh. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Up next, a massive scandal involving the construction industry, millions of dollars, and mistreated workers. Stay with us.